We're going to go ahead and call this meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we do have a quorum. First thing on the agenda is minutes from March 12th of 2026. Vice Chair Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I haven't. I move their approval.
Great. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So we have a great honor today to get a presentation from Form Energy, and they were here when I was on committee, like in 2019, 2020?
2023, I believe.
Oh, well, okay, time flies. So they've been here before, so it's great to have them back, especially given some of the recent announcements of their involvement on other projects in Minnesota. So with that, I want to welcome the members from Form Energy, and I'll just ask you to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you for having us. I'm Jason Houck, Policy Director.
I'm Joe Manser. I lead Form Futures, our advanced R&D and new product development team.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Acom and Co-Chair Swazinski for and other committee members for having us speak today about Form Energy. I'm Jason Houck, a policy director at Form Energy, and I'm pleased to be here. Joe directs our Form Futures, our R&D team within Form Energy, that also develops new products. As you may know, Form Energy is an American manufacturing company driving innovation in energy technology and manufacturing. The first technology that we're commercializing, which I think many of you probably heard about, is a new class of multi-day energy storage, an iron air battery technology, that will make the electric grid more reliable, more affordable, and cleaner. The last time we spoke was February 2023, and we've made a lot of exciting advancements since then. And we'll share updates both about our iron air battery technology and our projects with Minnesota utilities. But we also want to talk about iron. For the past 2 years, we've been working with the Natural Resources Research Institute, NRRI, to support research exploring how to use Minnesota iron ore in the long-duration energy storage supply chain. And we'll share updates about that work, which was funded by the legislature and the Department of Commerce. And then Joe's gonna share details about a new technology that we're developing to electrochemically produce high purity iron from low-grade iron ore feedstocks. And this new technology could serve not only our battery supply chain, but more importantly, and more extensively, the broader steel industry, which has the potential to bring significant benefits to Minnesota and the country more broadly. So let's focus on the battery first. Form Energy was founded in 2017 to address growing challenges facing the electric grid. You know, we've known for a while that electricity demand would grow exponentially, and AI has just supercharged that trend. At the same time, intermittent resources have become the lowest cost source of energy supply, but they're also weather dependent. And the weather itself has become more extreme, more frequently destructive to the electric grid and to the electricity supply. So the question we've been trying to solve since 2017 is how do we address these challenges, and principally through energy storage? And what kind of solution, new technology will help solve those kinds of problems? The answer is that we need new technologies like iron air batteries to provide clean, firm capacity. And those technologies need to be ready to deploy today to meet the challenges we currently have. To protect electric reliability and affordability, we need dispatchable resources that can turn up and down when needed, and that can reliably produce electricity for multiple days at a time during periods of high risk. So cold snaps, heat waves, periods when fuel prices spike and resources aren't available, oftentimes due to the weather. And this is why Form Energy is pioneering a new class of multi-day energy storage, and we're commercializing our 100-hour duration iron air batteries, which have high availability, a cost that can compete with natural gas power plants, and are ready to deploy today. And we'll talk about some of our advancements there. At right are just some images of some earlier stage systems. The top is an image from our factory of an enclosure. And at the bottom are several enclosures at a test facility in California that are connected to the electric grid. Our batteries use an iron air chemistry, by which we store and discharge electricity by reversibly rusting iron. That means that when we discharge our batteries, we're oxidizing or rusting high purity metallic iron. And when we charge our batteries, we're reversing that process. We're turning iron oxides back into metallic iron. This is not a new chemistry. It's been around for a long time. It's just never been commercialized for the electric grid. And we believe that iron air batteries are the lowest cost form of energy storage that is possible to make, that is presently known. Iron air batteries have a few advantages, one of them being they're incredibly safe. There's no mechanism for thermal runaway in these batteries, unlike lithium-ion batteries. They're also globally scalable and very durable. And the reason why we're able to achieve these very long durations, so this is, you know, 20 times more energy capacity than a typical battery in the grid today, is because we're using iron. And it's super abundant, super cheap, it's a low-cost material, and that unlocks the ability to store energy for far longer periods of time. This is some images of what the battery itself looks like. At the left, we have a cell. That's the smallest electrochemical unit. It's exactly what you would think of as a battery cell. Within there, though, that's where we have the iron anodes. So you can think of like a thin sheet of porous iron in a water-based electrolyte. That's in the cell. We'll stack several of those cells horizontally into a module, stack those into a tower, and then those will be within what we call a pack. And what comes out of our factory is all these components that are in the packs themselves, all rated at 100 hours of duration. And then we deploy those in the electric grid. So these are utility scale applications in modular, you know, multi-megawatt scale power blocks. So we could achieve, you know, any size system that a utility may need to solve whatever problem they have at a particular location. We're very proud that our first project is going to be with Great River Energy in Minnesota, in Cambridge. And this will be a 1.5 megawatt, 150 megawatt hour pilot project. We made pretty significant progress. This past fall, we shipped our first commercial iron air system to GRE's pilot site. This initial pilot was just four battery packs, but it was used to demonstrate the essential functional, the commercial functionality of the system. And the remaining packs are targeted for delivery later this year. This project will be followed by another one with Xcel Energy, a 10 megawatt project in Becker, Minnesota. And this will be a commercial demonstration project. And we have announced projects across the United States that'll be coming online in the next few years. Most recently, Xcel Energy announced that Form Energy will be deploying a 300 megawatt, which is a 30 gigawatt hour multi-day energy storage battery to help power a newly announced Google data center in Pine Island, Minnesota. This project stands as the largest battery system by energy capacity, so megawatt hours, that's been announced globally to date. And it also marks the first system that Form Energy will be deploying to power a data center, which demonstrates the unique value of our 100 hour batteries to meet the 24/7 energy needs of the AI economy and the grid at large. These projects are pretty notable, and we hope they will send a very powerful signal to the entire world that it's not only possible to achieve a reliable, cost-effective, clean grid, but that we can do it by manufacturing batteries right here in America to reduce reliance on foreign supply chains and to foster American energy independence. All of these batteries are going to be manufactured at Form Factory 1 in Weirton, West Virginia, with a supply chain that's 85% sourced domestically. When we last presented here, we had just announced that we would build our factory in West Virginia, but we had not yet broken ground. And since then, we constructed the factory in roughly a year's time, and we commenced commercial operation, and we're on track to reach 500 megawatts of production capacity per year by 2028. I think, interestingly, this factory sits on the site of the old Weirton Steel Plant, which is a historic steel community, formerly one of the largest steel mills in the country. The public benefit of manufacturing in the U.S. Is obvious. We support well-paid U.S. manufacturing jobs. We advance our domestic energy security. All this effort aligns with our mission, which is Form Energy's mission, which is to deploy energy storage for a better world. So we'll switch in a second to talking about iron. Right now, we source high purity iron in our battery manufacturing process. But we've been interested for many years in finding ways to upgrade and optimize U.S. ore to the purity we need in our batteries. So even though the science of using iron for steelmaking in buildings and finished goods is very well known at this point, the science of optimizing iron for use in batteries as an active battery component is new, and there's a lot of development work that still needs to be done. In the course of perfecting iron as a low-cost, high-performing battery component, we've learned that there's a lot of technical work and supply chain development that we still need to focus on before we can turn iron from the iron range into iron that can be used in our batteries. Our research with NRI over the past 2 years has been exploring how to use existing technologies and known processes to upgrade ores to meet our battery specifications. We made a lot of progress, and we were able to achieve incredibly high purity outputs with promising results in tests with our product. But we didn't yet reach the exact desired specification for our battery systems without further research. Around the same time that we were doing this work with NRI and began it, Joe's team made some serendipitous discoveries that in our research lab that led to a new method of cost-effectively producing high-purity metal iron from iron ore. And we believe this new technology is now a more promising path for us to take to unlock the ability of Minnesota ore, not just to supply Form Energy's battery supply chain, but more broadly to result in a expanding the portfolio of products that Minnesota ore can serve for the steel industry more broadly. And I'm going to hand this off to Joe now, who is going to tell you more about this work.
Okay, yeah. So first of all, thanks to the committee for having us here, and excited to talk about iron for both battery applications and for steelmaking, which is a little bit of a pivot for us as a company. And so as Jason mentioned, the first step in steelmaking is the separation of oxygen from iron. And when we charge our batteries, the iron in our anodes undergo the same transformation from iron oxide to iron metal. And so we spent the last 8 years or so perfecting that reaction in our battery to optimize performance. And as Jason mentioned, as part of a research effort, actually really aimed at looking at new methods for manufacturing our iron anodes for our batteries, we discovered a method to convert iron ore to high purity iron metal with high throughput and high efficiency under conditions that are very similar to the conditions that our battery operates under. And those specifically are less than the boiling point of water, so less than 100 degrees Celsius. This is done at low temperature, using only electricity and with zero emissions. So those are really the only, we'll talk a little bit more about the byproducts of the process in the next slide. But I did want to say that, we've been thinking about this for a long time. So in 2022, Form Energy published an article called The Iron Energy Nexus, which is the title of the slide here. And this really laid out a vision for the synergy between low-cost electricity enabled by our iron air batteries, electrified iron making, and domestic steel making. So with our new cost-effective electrochemical iron making technology, I'm going to tell you a little bit about more in the next slides, serving both batteries and steel making, we believe we've unlocked this nexus, opening opportunities to produce an exciting new array of products from Minnesota iron ore for the 21st century. Okay, so just to step back a little bit and think about and talk about the steelmaking industry, we've been talking about batteries. So I want to talk about what's going on in steel. So this innovation comes at a key moment as the U.S. steel industry is undergoing a fundamental shift toward a growing reliance on iron metal produced from ore, also known as ore-based metallics or virgin iron units. So you'll hear me use those interchangeably. So the U.S. steel industry is dominated by the processing of iron-bearing scrap in electric arc furnaces. So we make about 70% of our steel in this country in electric arc furnaces, and those are using mostly scrap as feedstock. In an EAF, electricity is used to melt scrap and ore-based metallics to produce molten metal that can be further refined and cast into iron and steel parts. So we are, in the U.S., the number three steel producer in the world, which is pretty good, but we rank 20th in iron production. And that just highlights our heavy reliance on scrap. So we make a lot of steel. We actually don't make that much iron from a global perspective. And there's this trend that we're tracking here, and this is a broader industry. There's broader industry consensus here that in order to produce high-grade steel, we need high-quality scrap. It's called prime scrap. This prime scrap has low concentration of unwanted elements that are known as tramp elements or residuals. And they also rely on using these virgin iron units from ore to dilute those impurities to maintain steel product quality. So the supply of high-quality scrap is declining, and demand is increasing as more steelmakers move towards electrified steelmaking processes like the electric arc furnace. So with this growing gap for high-quality scrap, the demand for ore-based metallics is expected to increase significantly in the United States, which is good news for Minnesota that produces a lot of iron ore. So if we go to the next slide. So I want to talk a little bit about the technology and some details behind it and what sets it apart from incumbent and emerging technologies in this space. So first, Form's iron product is a unique high surface area, high purity iron powder that is well suited for direct use in battery applications. That's important. For steelmaking applications, it can be readily densified into pellets or briquettes. So Mike has a sample there that we brought. It can pass around. So that's iron metal powder produced in our process using Minnesota taconite ore. So this powder morphology is not only important for the end use application like batteries, it also allows us to run our process with continuous material flows that achieve high production throughput, which is a key attribute that enables us to achieve cost parity with traditional incumbent iron making technologies. So if you look at the process flow diagram down on the left-hand side of the slide, the process is fed with iron ore fines or concentrates that undergo minimal but very important front-end processing to meet our electrolyzer specifications, and that's going to be important when we talk about work that we're scoping with NRI. We eliminate the iron ore pellet manufacturing process or the need to produce iron ore pellets, which, you know, from a capital stack perspective, as we think about expanding iron supply and iron ore production, not having to build those briquetting or those pelletization facilities is a savings. As the ore moves through our process, we separate the impurities selectively from the ore, and they're removed from the system, and they can be sold into the chemical or cement industry as co-products. The only other byproduct from this process is pure oxygen. So there, again, no emissions from this technology. It just takes ore and electricity in, iron metal, oxygen, and the impurities out. So this process is able to produce high-purity iron from lower-grade ores, which is important for Minnesota. Consumes 20 to 30% less energy than traditional iron-making processes. And taking inspiration from our battery, which, you know, operates on the grid flexibly, can be operated to respond to grid stress events and price signals, so we can turn the factory down, turn the operation down in a responsive way, which lowers the cost of power and facilitates system integration. Okay, so zooming in a little bit on the feedstocks that we're able to work with and why that's important for Minnesota. So the majority of the roughly 40 million metric tons of iron ore that's produced in the U.S. is used in traditional blast furnace, basic oxygen furnace steelmaking operations. So these are the most emission-intensive and energy-intensive steelmaking routes that we have today. However, as we discussed a few slides ago, the demand for iron is expected to be driven by new EAF capacity. So there's about 13 million tons of new electric arc furnace capacity that has been announced or is planned in the U.S. In the coming years, as well as this gap in the prime scrap supply that I mentioned earlier. So EAF steelmaking typically requires less than 3% total gang, and that gang is the impurity elements in the ore, mostly focused on silica and alumina. Form's battery applications has even more stringent purity requirements. And this, again, was some of the focus of the work that we had done previously with NNRI, was trying to meet those more stringent requirements. So the data on the left in this slide demonstrates the purifying power of our electrochemical iron-making process when applied to a blast furnace pellet feed coming out of the Mesabi Range. Key impurities in the incoming ore, including silicon, aluminum, and phosphorus, which is a known poison in steelmaking. That's represented by the blue bars there you can see in the graph. They're reduced more than 90% in our e-iron or electrolytic iron product, which is represented by the red bars. So this is data coming out of our lab. And the table on the right shows our iron product specifications. So these specifications are derived from ore that would typically be used in a blast furnace to produce pig iron. And Form's product, just from that table, you can see has superior metallization, so the actual iron metal content in the powder or the product that's coming out of the iron making step is higher, as well as lower impurity content relative to the incumbent products. So this data highlights the opportunity to expand the reach of Minnesota's existing mining products and potentially alternative feedstocks like mine tailings into new steelmaking and battery applications without the need to expand mineral processing capabilities. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about some of the support we've received so far for this from the federal side. So Form's development has been supported in part by a $1 million award under the DOE's Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy, or ARPA-E, through their ROSI program. So we've been leading a team over the last 18 months to de-risk key aspects of our technology, including component and device performance, domestic ore testing, and cost analysis. So the team comprises Form Energy as the lead, as well as a major U.S. steelmaker with operations in the Mesabi Range. There's not that many of them. And university partners, MIT and University of Oregon. So this program is going very well. We've met or exceeded all of our program milestones, and we're seeking to build on this momentum with support from private and public funds. So the last slide we have to present to you all today is looking at our path to scale with this new technology. So we're planning to commission a first-of-a-kind commercial demonstration facility in 2030 with a goal to begin supplying domestic iron to Form's batteries and the broader steel industry in major quantities in the early 2030s through expansion of our demonstration facility and through additional plant development. We will be looking for locations to site our commercial demonstration facility starting in late 2027 or early 2028. Right now, we're in the what we would call the early engineering stage, which will take us to a production rate of about 15 metric tons per year over the next 2 years. So these are still small quantities with relation to steel, but we're starting to get to larger quantities with respect to, you know, moving out of the R&D and into engineering. That will be followed by a pilot phase with a production capacity of about 5,000 metric tons of iron per year. And then our commercial demonstration facility will initially have a capacity of 25,000 metric tons per year of iron production. This capacity represents what we think is the smallest kind of modular building block of a larger factory. And capacity expansion would really be kind of a copy paste of this 25,000 ton module. And above the timeline, we're showing some of the feedstock development milestones, which is important as we think about using domestic ores in this iron-making technology. The next 2 years is very important for us to define which feedstocks we will target for use in our pilot operations and ultimately in our commercial operations. So we're aiming to develop a comprehensive feedstock specification over the next year, which tells us which raw materials will perform well in our process, and to identify domestic feedstocks that can meet that specification. We will then execute an engineering demonstration of an ore processing circuit, or the equipment that kind of gets put together to meet a certain specification for the ore, capable of processing the raw material to meet that spec using commercially representative equipment. This learning then will ultimately be translated into our pilot and commercial stages. You know, we're working right now with NRI to scope work to help support this learning that we need to do over the next 2 years leading into our pilot operation. And, you know, we're engaging with stakeholders across Minnesota to help advance our feedstock development efforts. So with that, again, we wanted to thank the committee for your time, and hopefully this gives you at least a brief overview of some of our new product development efforts going on at Form. And we're very excited about working with Minnesota and, you know, for the sourcing feedstock, as well as doing technology development. And with that, I think we'll open it for questions. Thank you.
Thank you both for that. That was a lot of information, and we do have some questions, but I'm gonna maybe just start off with one. I have a battery in my electric car, I have power walls in my house, and over time, they're supposed to be less, have less capacity, like it degrades. Does that happen with this type of technology as well, or is that less a factor? So, Mr. Hoff?
It's a great question. Our battery doesn't degrade in power, but we do lose some ability to store energy over time. So at the end, of like a 15-year, for example, you know, system life, you might be down to like 80, 85% energy capacity. So from like the electric grid standpoint, we care about both power and energy. From a sort of reliability standpoint, it's equivalent power that you're paying for, mm-hmm. more than enough energy capacity to still provide a really robust reliability service to the grid.
And then just one more question in terms of that. Is there, are there concerns about recycling? Can they be reused and, or the recycling issue? There's some concerns about the batteries for my car, for example.
Yeah, I would say in our case, it's actually an exciting opportunity. The battery itself is highly, has the potential to be highly recyclable. I think it's more than 90% recyclable. You know, what's in it is the iron that Joe mentioned, which still has value at the end of its life, plastics and water. And then some, the electrolyte that is in the battery also has some chemicals in it that we can basically extract out and sell for other processes. So it is highly recyclable. In our projects, we do have plans to end of life, like how do you decommission, what do you do with the stuff? And it's actually in our interest to kind of take the battery back and try to maximize the value of it at the end of its system life.
Well, I appreciate the thought being put at this stage. So thank you for that. And first on the list for questions, Representative Jones, who welcome back to committee.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be back. So thank you, Chair, and thank you, presenters, for this. It's really exciting technology you have here. I have a question, I guess more of a clarification. So you showed a map where you have projects coming up here soon-ish to be built. And so those are going to be using feedstocks, traditional feedstocks, and not what you have here on the last slide. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. The last slide that Joe showed, basically, if we continue to have success in scaling up this technology at this pace, it'll achieve a scale that we need to support the battery manufacturing itself, probably in the early 2030s. So hopefully at that point, there will be an intersection of our battery manufacturing and our iron production that we can start to serve our own battery needs. At present, we are, we are sourcing iron from we source high purity metallic iron. And we would like to make that, sourced fully domestically as soon as we possibly can.
Awesome. Representative Jones?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and speakers here. That's useful. And then the other question I have is regards to, so the impurities, can you just say again what happens to the impurities, what they are, and then is that something that you can, is it sellable? Can you get revenue for it, help to drive down the cost of batteries? Just curious about that.
Mr. Manser.
Absolutely, yeah. So the impurities are taken out of the system in a solid form, and they absolutely can be sold primarily into the cement industry, I would say. So they're going to contain mostly aluminum and silicon oxides as the impurity phase that we're going to that we take out of our solution. And so we think they have, they're not super, super high value, but they definitely, in terms of circularity and the ability to use those impurities, we absolutely think there's a use case for that.
Great. Any further? Nope. Next on the list, we have Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation. We're not all going to say that every time. That's going to get irritating. Yeah. I have a couple of questions. The first one is, let's see, what is the energy density of these batteries compared to lithium ion batteries or any other grid storage?
Mr. Hawk.
Good question. The batteries themselves are at this point roughly, the density on the energy side is 300 megawatt hours per acre, which is I think a little bit more dense than lithium ion batteries. We're less dense on a power basis. So you get fewer megawatts per acre, but more energy per acre.
Mm. Representative Hollins.
Okay, sorry, I'm trying to take notes.
No, yes,
while doing it.
Okay,
and the other question I had was first of all, is the goal to have them be viable in a residential usage, or is this purely for grid usage? And then if that is the goal, how close are we to something like that?
Mr. Hawk.
Yeah, this technology is intended just for utility scale applications. So I think the Google project is kind of one example of we do target large commercial and industrial customers. There is an opportunity to potentially co-locate projects there, but these require a lot of land. And they are large and heavy. So we're not going to be, they won't be in people's homes or small businesses, but so we're really targeting, multi-megawatt utility scale projects. The nice thing is the technology is modular, so it could really go anywhere in the electric grid. It's very flexible geographically.
Representative Hollins?
Okay, last question. Why West Virginia?
Great question. Everyone in Minnesota asks that. I forget the number of states that we looked at a number of sites. It was something like several hundred sites that we evaluated. For this first manufacturing facility, we needed something that was really perfect that could allow us to just move very quickly. It had to have like all the right attributes. This site of West Virginia, you know, it was the site of a former steel mill. So it had rail, river, and hardened highway access. So that from a logistics standpoint, it was kind of perfect. The site was basically had already been redeveloped and prepared for a new industry. That particular area of the country has a lot of know-how in manufacturing and working with metal in particular. And then we had tremendous support from the state to help us move very quickly to get that facility online rapidly. So that's our first factory. And we plan to continue expanding on that site. We have more capacity physically to expand. And we'll be thinking about, you know, what comes next in the next few years.
Maybe even Minnesota. We'll see. Anything else, Representative Hollins, or are you finished? Okay. Next, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Super interesting. I've got a bunch of questions. So you in your cost approach, you said you're on par with gas peakers. Where are you in your cost curve? Because gas peakers have been around a while. And I think, especially if I look at the modularity that you're building into this, I imagine you're early on your cost curve and you would, the goal with this is to be way less cost over time. Am I right?
Mr. Hawk.
Yes, absolutely right. Our CEO likes to say, to get down the cost curve, you got to get on the cost curve. Yeah. So right now, you know, we're manufacturing, we're on it. And the cost curve comes down as you increase scale of manufacturing and you improve the performance of the battery over time. And so our goal is, you know, when we're at full commercial scale around 2030, to get down to a total installed cost of less than $20 per kilowatt hour. So that's CapEx divided by duration. That's the price point that we think really is needed to unlock the full potential of renewables, to be reliable and these costs every hour of the year, and for our technology to really to scale more globally.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. And this is a key point to point out, is that in these new technology areas, we're generally talking about technology cost curves and learning how to work with the technology, where in fossil fuel stuff, you got to dig it out every time. So there's no cost curve there. So has this been taking longer than you anticipated? And if so, why?
Mr. Hawk.
Yeah, bringing in any new technology to market is hard. I think for sure, there have been some great interviews with our CEO in the last, this past year, talking about some of the challenges and learnings we've had on the manufacturing side. From my perspective, the rate of change has been incredibly fast. So I was in the regulatory space before joining Form, and I joked to my former colleagues, former regulators, that, you know, they would open a proceeding and we would build a factory before they'd close the proceeding, you know, dealing with one particular issue. So the pace of change is very rapid. I think this is a really exciting phase for the company where we're transitioning into a manufacturing company and just learning a lot in the process. And it takes time, but we, you know, are excited to be deploying more batteries in Minnesota this year. And that'll be really the point at which the technology is fully proven to the grid.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you also talked about that this is the thing you've announced with Xcel is first one for a data center. Are there different challenges for you with data centers versus other applications versus other utility scale applications, or is it just this is the first time?
Mr. Hawk.
I don't know if there are particular – it's a good question. I think, you know, we're supplying batteries to electricity providers. So in this case, to Xcel, we partner with project developers. And so we're really giving them a tool to help provide, you know, in a portfolio of other resources to provide reliable energy to the end customer, whether it's a data center or someone else. And so unfortunately, I think the utilities really have like the harder challenge. We're giving them the tool and the sort of, you know, we help them operate our battery system most effectively within their broader portfolio. And that's what we're trying to focus on, is how do we serve, you know, the power needs that our customers have, in this case, Xcel Energy.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One comment, and then I've got questions on the new iron-making thing. So I noticed, and correct me later, that your manufacturing plant capacity was 500 megawatts,
yeah,
and the XL deployment is 300 megawatts. So that's like most of a year. So I imagine you're going to be needing another manufacturing facility or to expand that, and seemed like a great place for it might be nearby your iron supply. Anyway, if you don't use iron from the Iron Range for this, where do you get it from?
Mr. Hawk.
We can't list our suppliers by name, but we currently source the high purity iron internationally, and we're looking to source it also from domestic suppliers. But we're buying already the high purity iron. We're not, you know, engaging with the upstream, the ore suppliers. And that's kind of where we, you know, the work we're doing with NRI in the past few years and the work Joe is doing is going to help us basically figure out, like, there's every ore is different, and we need to find the pathway to really, in particular, unlock Minnesota ore to meet our battery specs. And right now we're just sourcing high purity iron that already meets our spec.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm winding down here. So, you know, you're an exciting new company, and you're trying to do this great thing on the battery side, and now it seems like you're trying to do another thing on the creating a new way of doing iron. Sounds like a lot. Can you, I mean, I'd love for you to knock it both out of the park, but can you do both?
Mr. Hawk.
Maybe Joe might be best to handle it because he leads the R&D team.
Mr. Manson.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I guess I'll go back to the founding. It's maybe an interesting place to start here for this question, but it does have a reason. So we, you know, when the company was founded, we were going after a market problem, which was the need for multi-day storage. And we had a number of chemistries on the table that were being considered, and we've sort of talked openly about that, that sort of down selection process that we went through to arrive at Iron Air as the chemistry we felt had the best entitlement to deliver on the market needs. But, you know, through that, we've built this sort of into the DNA of the company, these sort of R&D and new product development efforts as we were developing these chemistries in parallel in the early stages of development for the multi-day storage. So we've carried that desire to be a multi-product company since the very beginning. And in our board and our execs are very supportive of that and interested in that outcome. But to your point, yes, it's, you know, these are two, you know, these are, this is deep tech, both of these things, so they require a lot of time, a lot of capital. And we are right now thinking about, you know, as we're going through these stages of scaling up, you know, the roadmap we talked about for the iron making technology, that's going to require more capital, more personnel in order to achieve those goals. And this is where things like non-dilutive funding are really, really, really helpful for us, because we've got our main path that we're on, and we have this exciting kind of side quest that we're going down, and that's where those non-dilutive funds and the, you know, federal and state support can be really, really impactful for us. But we are actively discussing, you know, what is the right kind of corporate structure to make sure both of these things can be supported in the way that they need to be.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And last question, comment. So what's the timeline for the XL data center when you expect to deliver that? I was looking through the announcements and I didn't see that. And then, it seems like if we can figure out if you can scale this on the iron making side, I can't imagine a more natural place to put something like that than close to where the ore is coming out of the ground. And I wish Representative Igo was here.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Mr. Hawk.
The Excel project to support Google will be deployed. Right now the timeline is 2028, 2029 for us to start delivering those batteries to Excel. I think the question about where to site, you know, if this new technology that Joe's developing continues to scale, I mean, there are going to be some interesting questions about where it doesn't make the most sense to locate it. And I think, you know, this is a topic we intend to keep you very closely updated on over the years as we make progress. And, you know, I look forward to having those conversations with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the list, Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Very interesting. Going back to slide 4, I was wondering if you could actually put some real numbers against on par with gas peakers.
Mr. Hawk.
Yeah, it's the right the way we think about cost is typically through a, unfortunately, through like a system plan. Like you have to look at the portfolio and what technology solves for least cost. And the conversation we have with a lot of utilities is really begins with modeling, where we model our technology, other resources, other technology types, including nuclear, gas, geothermal, and we ask the question honestly, given your portfolio, given the weather, what makes the most sense? And in some locations, it might be gas. In other locations, it might be multi-day storage. And that's really the question that we try to answer through analysis. And it depends a lot on the portfolio you have and the region of the country and what natural resources you have in that location. The reason why we set that target is because that's gases right now. That's what's on the margin. That's the historically what has been built next in the grid to serve reliability needs. And when we think about what other solutions does the grid need, we look at gas operations to kind of indicate, like in a heat wave or a cold spell, how many days at a time is it operating? And we use that as a benchmark to say, well, we need a resource that can behave like that if it's a battery. And for us, that means that it needs to be able to discharge for several days at a time to kind of mimic gas plant operations. So kind of indirect way of getting at the question. We put some numbers out there about our costs 2030 plus for folks who are modeling the electric grid. But we can't speak more specifically about our costs at this moment.
Representative Sexton, did you have a follow-up?
I would. I mean, so it'd be easier if I gave a word problem and basically said, I want to respect for a peaker plant or batteries to basically cover a 72-hour peak period of 100 megawatts. And you compared those two.
Mr. Hawk?
Yeah, and if I'm... It sounds like you're asking for like a dollar figure, like CapEx.
I mean, and that, pretty but, much, yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, you haven't talked much about OpEx either. Does it take a lot of people to run this facility versus maybe something else like a peaker plant?
I wish I had those numbers at the tip of my tongue, but I think that's one I'll have to get back to you on with the specific comparison, which I think our team would be happy to do.
Very good. Thanks.
Great. You can just send that to the committee and we'll send it out to folks. Okay. Thank you.
I do have several more.
Open. Please continue, Mr. Representative Sexton.
So you talked a little bit about your electrolyte. Of course, obviously in the world today, we're very concerned about PFAS and everything else. Can you expand upon how you would dispose of the electrolyte at the end of the cycle?
Mr. Hawk.
The way I understand it is we will, and Joe can correct me, but and we may have to get our engineers to talk more specifically about this too, we recover it and we reduce it and try to, I think, pull the elements out of it. So it's when we decommission the plant, I think we literally take the electrolyte out and then we reprocess it.
Representative Sexton.
Can you expand upon how hazardous it is and things like that?
Mr. Hawk.
It's kind of similar to the electrolyte that's in a AA battery. That's the closest comparison. So it's a basic solution. So it's caustic. It's not something you want to handle, but it is not incredibly, it's not toxic. It's not like a highly hazardous material, but you have to handle it very carefully. So kind of like, Drano or like a AA battery, those are the closest comparisons to what the electrolyte is. It's a basic salt.
Okay.
Representative Sexton.
One more. When you mentioned the cost per kilowatt, I didn't quite catch that. Can you repeat that?
Yeah.
Mr. Hawk.
We say $20 per kilowatt hour. So you take the CapEx of $2,000 per kilowatt divided by 100 hours gets you $20 per kilowatt hour. There's been a number of sort of trade studies that say that's the cost that energy storage really needs to be able to hit to really enable a reliable, cost-effective, clean grid. And that's what we're aiming for. And that's the cost that we're targeting when we hit full commercial economies of scale in our manufacturing in the early 2030s.
Any follow-up?
One more observation.
You bet. Go ahead.
You may not have noticed it because it's in your footnote, but your slides are marked confidential.
They are. These are public. We share them with the committee. That's just a footnote that I apologize I didn't take out in advance of this.
So they'll be available. We can put them on our website?
That's correct. And I think, Mike, are they already publicly available? Okay, great.
It's there.
Okay. Just so you know, that is the exact font they use in the national security world. You may want to change your font.
Okay. Thank you for calling that out.
And Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you're creating the plates, I'm guessing you use 3D printing?
Mr. Hawk.
I'm sorry. Can you say that one more time?
So you're creating the plates that go within the stacks. Is it you're using 3D printing or using milling or kind of what?
Joe, back me up on this, but I think, so what we do is we take powdered form of iron and we put them in trays and we basically heat them up and we press them. So it's kind of like a brake pad. It's a very similar process to that. It's not 3D printed.
That's right. Great.
Representative Susan?
And then just a secondary. So, you know, as that powder is being processed, you know, obviously you're getting it from overseas for that purity content that you're looking for. Kind of at what stage does the powder come to the States and into your factory? So obviously you're not doing all the process. You're not taking the raw processed. You're not removing the silica in the United States. I'm guessing a vast majority of that, those processes are done overseas, correct?
Mr. Hawk.
Yeah, it's my understanding that is correct. We are, I think, sourcing iron that's already been processed that meets our spec. Yeah.
Representative Susan.
I'll confirm that with our team, too, and get back to you.
What was that?
Yeah, I'll try to confirm that with our team, but that's my understanding. Is we're sourcing iron that's already at the spec that we need. We're not... For example, we're not reducing the iron ourselves. We're buying from people who already do that.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Great.
And then just from a process standpoint, looking at kind of your timelines that you began the project, you know, I think it was brought, the question was brought up, you know, why not Minnesota? And one of the issues that we do see when it comes to manufacturing oftentimes is permitting time. And so when it comes to doing anything of substance, you know, as the test fires talked about, you know, the state was very aggressive in the way they worked, and what that is code word for is they were very friendly when it came to permitting and the ability for the build a project out quickly. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, we as a state should be looking at, not only for this industry, but industry-wide when it comes to manufacturing in total. So that's all.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I do want to just get a little closer on the cost. I mean, this is $20 per kilowatt. You know, we're used to talking about cost per megawatt. And I'm just wondering, you know, when you look at energy production for coal, nuclear, natural gas, how do you see that comparing in the cost to generate power that we can use?
Mr. Hawk.
So the cost per kilowatt hour that we deliver today is already 10 times cheaper than what lithium-ion batteries can produce. So it's already a very low cost source of reliable energy when it's needed. But yeah, we do need support sources of energy generation. And we can take energy from whatever resource is on the grid and we'll charge when it's cheapest. The analysis that we do oftentimes with developers and utility partners is we'll say, okay, we need 24/7 energy and we'll compare, like, what are the ways to do that? Oftentimes, if it's a thermal resource that's retiring, you'll ask what performance do we need to mirror that, and what's the lowest cost option. So that comparison is less about like sticker price and more about analysis within the electricity grid, because it depends on other sources of energy that are available. And so obviously we want to be setting our batteries where there are abundant sources of low cost energy that we can charge from. And when there are periods of scarcity where prices spike and when, you know, energy is needed to be discharged, those are the kinds of the ideal markets for us. And I think the reason why I've seen so much interest in the upper Midwest is because of the dynamics of the market here, which, you know, extreme weather, low cost sources of renewables that are variable, and a need to kind of maximize the value of those assets in a way that lowers costs overall for the whole system.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair. Thank you. When it comes to the electricity that this is harboring for us to be able to use, you know, when you look at, I've visited with my, just recently with an electric company and just threw out some numbers that I had learned a number of years ago, but like $37 per megawatt for nuclear, $35 per megawatt to produce is kind of an average cost. Well, on yours, for us to have electricity that we can use, that'd be $20,000 per megawatt. At $20 a kilowatt, if you convert it to megawatts, it's $20,000. So that's the cost of the electricity. When we're going to use your electricity, that's what it sounds like to me. Can you give me a little more clarification?
Yeah, and I apologize if I misspoke or didn't explain it well. The target that we're aiming for in post-2030 is effectively a $2,000 per kilowatt CapEx cost. Which at 100 hours of duration is $20 per kilowatt hour, so an energy cost. So the $2,000 CapEx, that's the goal that we're trying to achieve at full economies of scale.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my point is that we were, as a members of our communities really want to know what that real cost looks like. When we're going to be buying power in the future, we really, really want to know what that is. And so we hope that we get those kind of numbers from you in the future. And it's good to compare it. We just need to know if we're truly interested in getting to the 2040, we need to know what it's going to cost too.
Yeah.
And so it's really important for us to get those numbers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good point. Seeing no further questions, want to thank the presenters for coming today. Appreciate you. And keep Minnesota front of mind. And really appreciate the work that you're, the partnerships that you have here in our state and the work that's being done. We look forward to seeing it come to life. So thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And so next on the agenda, we're going to hear a couple of bills today. We have House File 4059, Representative Luger Nicolai. You can make your way to the testifier table. And while she does that, maybe I will go ahead and move that House File 4059 be laid over for possible inclusion. And as you're getting settled there, I do believe there is an A1 to get the bill in the shape that you would like. So would you like to move your A1?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1. That makes two fairly minor changes to the bill. One allows the agency to, or the authority to spend money that they take in, so that making sure that authority is clear. And then secondly, one that ensures that the general fund is shielded from the effects of the remainder of the bill, effectively.
Great. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So with that, please go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 4059 enables MnCIFA to borrow money, to spend grant money, and to bundle securitized instruments to sell to financial institutions in a way that frees up capital for additional loans so that they can expand the portfolio of projects that they are currently working on. It allows MnCIFA effectively to leverage investment opportunities to actually do more investing on its end and to ensure that our private sector energy development continues apace. On February 24th, we heard from MnCIFA about the projects that they're currently investing in to promote private sector development of sustainable, climate-supportive energy projects. And they were absolutely crystal clear about the exhaustive financial metrics that they use in order to ensure that a particular project is creditworthy and would generate a real return on investment. And so now what MnCIFA is asking for and what this bill would provide would be the ability to more fully tap into private sector investment and philanthropic funds in order to create more lending opportunities for Minnesota businesses. Now, this is authority that the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency already has and that the IRRRB also has, so we are not inventing anything new or doing anything edgy. And critically, the A1 amendment that we just added ensures that as a matter of statute, the state of Minnesota would not be on the hook for investing decisions on the part of MnCIFA. They are the responsibility of MnCIFA. And so this proposal is budget neutral, but creates capital opportunities and really just kind of expands the pie in a way that we always like to have happen. So with that, I'm going to actually turn it over to Kari.
Great. Welcome back to committee, Ms. Gross-Swan. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, chairs, and thank you, committee members, for considering this legislation. Thank you for introducing it. For the record, I am Kari Gross-Swan, Executive Director of the Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority. There are really three compelling reasons why House File 4059 is needed. Number one, the challenge that we are facing is that demand for MnCIFA financing is on track to exceed the capital we have available for loans. Our 2026 call for applications, which opened in February, is aiming to finance projects in greater Minnesota, rural areas, and tribes. We have more than $150 million currently in our pipeline of projects, and that is more than the capital we have available. As you may recall, the call plans to finance $50 million in projects. We are currently running out of capital and will be unable to meet the demand. We can expand with private capital, such as private banks, private investors, philanthropic foundations, and donor-advised funds, our capital stack. The number two reason that is compelling is in our statute, we are called to provide innovative financing and crowd in capital from other sources in order to accelerate the state's transition to clean energy. For the loans we have, there is currently private capital in those loans. If you recall the last time I was here, I talked about our leverage. For every dollar we loan out, we crowd in an additional $5. That is a great return on investment for Minnesota taxpayers and for our financing authority. We want to do more. Number three, our financing partners are asking us to have these financing tools. I would like to point to our letters of support. We have three community banks who have partnered with us or are actively currently partnering with us. MinWest has 35 locations statewide. Stearns Bank is located in St. Cloud, and Sunrise is located here in St. Paul. All of those banks, two of them are actively in our pipeline with closed loans, and the third is actively wanting to finance with us. We also have these financing tools, as in their letters of support, you will note, are common banking industry practices that any community bank would have. They're very minor tweaks to our statute. I would also like to point to the letter of support we have from the Minnesota Council of Foundations. They are very interested in providing PRIs, which are known as program-related investments. These are low-cost loans that they would give to us that would then stretch our dollars to go further. With that, I would just like to say that we are bringing loan money here. These are not grants. These are catalytic loans that we are lending out and getting back. We are not asking the state for money. We are asking for the ability to crowd in money. And I would just punctuate that we have worked very closely with MMB. There is no fiscal impact, and this is budget neutral. And with that, I will turn it back to Representative or go to questions.
Well, I just want to, as I'm looking around the table to see if there's any questions from members, I want to thank you for being back here. I appreciate the work. I think your return on investment speaks for itself. I have one quick question. And with these minor technical changes, do you think that that would change that return on investment at all, improve it even in any capacity, Ms. Grosswan?
Thank you, Chair. Certainly I do. In our current call for applications and in our current pipeline, we are seeing our leverage increase up to close to 7-to-1 on loans that we have actually already approved by the board but are not closed. And that's because two of the loans in that portfolio are the advanced manufacturing tax credits. Those have a larger capital stack, and so we are seeing a greater return ROI on our investments.
That's great. I think in the short time that MNCIFA has been around, you're doing incredible work. So thank you for that. And it certainly is evident in the projects that have been funded. So Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you might have covered this. I'm sorry, I had to step out for a second. But there are other states that have this type of rotating loan program that are allowed these same provisions, correct?
Ms. Grosswan.
Chair, Representative, yes. We are part of what is affectionately known as the Green Bank ecosystem. There are only 8 states in the country that do not have a finance authority completely dedicated to renewable energy projects. Some of those are state agencies. Some of those are quasi-public private organizations like the Met Council or the St. Paul Port Authority, and some of them are nonprofit organizations. All of what we are asking for are tweaks and financing structures that a lot of the state green banks that have preceded us already have in their statute. So these are very simple financing tools that we are just asking to be amended. We believe that this is already written into our statute as written, but as we've worked with the reviser, we want to ask permission instead of come back and, you know, ask for forgiveness down the line.
Any follow-up, Representative Hollins?
I guess, you know, I'm not a banking expert. I guess I'm just wondering how it's working out for those other states.
Ms. Grosswan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. A lot of the other state green banks have been in existence for 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. Their return on investment and the amount of loans that they have been able to recycle and go back out into the community approach the hundreds of millions of dollars. The Green Bank of New York, the Green Bank of Massachusetts, California, Illinois, they've been around for a very long time. The ROI that they're seeing and the deployment of projects in their states is massive. I would also like to say that Texas, most recently, because of some of their environmental challenges, both with extreme heat and mm-hmm. extreme cold, have really stepped up their deployment of renewable energy projects through their green financing arms.
Representative Collins, great. No further questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question. So you said you have about 150 million or 115 million projects in the pipeline and not that much amount for that you could potentially loan out. Have any of those projects said if they don't receive funding through you, the projects won't happen?
Ms. Grosswan.
Thank you, Representative Chair and Representative Swazinski. We certainly know that there will be stranded assets that will not move forward without our financing. We know that that we have already funded two projects that the loans have gone out that came to us and said, but for our capital, your project would not have gone forward. Just as a reminder from my last testimony, we fund just a very small portion of that capital stack funding the energy savings component. And we do know of two that would not have moved forward without our capital. We are in the early phases of evaluating the call for applications. That window closed, the first window. We are evaluating those projects now. We will be opening that up again as an accordion probably later this month or early in April.
Representative Swazinski.
And then just, Madam Chair, and then so it's my understanding that you received some sort of a infusion of cash. So when the federal government did what they did, there was some money essentially left on the table and those dollars were transferred to you. Are those still in your hold or are they already, have they already been spent or loaned out?
Ms. Grosswan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So just to recap our capital stack, we have $50 million that was frozen or clawed back, if you will, from the federal government. That was a grant from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, Coalition for Green Capital, and our Solar for All. We initially received a $45 million appropriation, thank you, in 2023, and we did receive a $60 million transfer from the State Competitiveness Fund number 2 via Commerce. And we are using those funds for taking advantage of the tax credits, both the solar and wind and the geothermal and the storage and the advanced manufacturing, which continue. To date, we have either closed out and money's dispersed or we have approved close to $40 million in loans out the door and approved. We have held $50 million for this call for applications. If you do your math, 45 plus 60 is 105. That's 90. That leaves us with $15 million that we are looking to hold back both for our loan loss reserve, to look to design more financial products, and also for new technologies that might be coming in our pipeline. So we are definitely in need of excess capital to deploy.
Representative Swazinski, anything else? Next, we have Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. And Ms. Grosswan. So let me just sort of go to a higher level here and make sure I get this, because I would love for us to, rather than lay this over, send it to the floor, because it just seems like such a no-brainer. But maybe I'm getting it. Let's not even talk about what it is you're doing, right? Let's just talk purely from a financial perspective. It sounds like you're asking for something that has no direct impact to our general fund and taxpayers.
Correct.
It's consistent with the mission of your agency, and it will increase economic activity, which will then generate more tax receipts for the state of Minnesota and for our, because there's more economic activity. Do I have that right?
Ms. Grosswan.
Chair Acom, Representative Kraft. Yes, you do have that right. We, if you recall from my last presentation of the loans that we have already dispersed, we have created 975 jobs across the state. This is lowering energy costs. It is spurring economic development statewide, and it is making energy more affordable. I will also remind you that over 90% of our projects have currently been in environmental justice communities. So we are benefiting those who can least afford their energy costs to go up.
Sounds like a win-win-win-win. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So colleagues across the aisle here, I would love for us to send this to the floor. And I promise not even to talk about it, actually, if we do. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you stumbled across the interesting term, loan loss reserve. So I just wanted to ask, I mean, banks have defaults. Yep. So where does the state within your program lie on a default? Do all the private investors get paid first of the selling off the assets and everything? Or does the state get paid first? Where do we lie as, you know, monitoring taxpayer dollars?
Ms. Grosswan.
Chair Acom, Representative Sexton. Great question. In most of our loans, we are in a first position. Our loans average a 4 to 7 year duration. We are short. We take collateral on every one of our loans. Every loan is a little bespoke. So, you know, when I say most, there are one or two where we may be in a secondary position, but we've got strong collateral. And you're right, every community bank has a loan loss reserve. We don't expect down the line every loan to be 100% successful. The I in MNCFA stands for innovation, and we are called to take some risks. But currently, through our loan servicing process, we have no loans on our watch list. We do quarterly and annual reviews, which with every loan that's being serviced. My CFO, who heads up our loan servicing program, is here today. And we feel that we are very strong stewards of your taxpayer dollars. And I, coming from the banking industry, take that very, very seriously.
Representative Sexton.
So if you do have a higher risk loan, because you said most, do you charge a higher interest rate then? Or what other mitigating factors to prevent loss or at least protect the taxpayer of the state of Minnesota? What are your tools?
Ms. Grosswan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Sexton. Every loan is evaluated on its own merits. We have a really deep preliminary application and then due diligence. We're looking at the backgrounds of the developers. We're looking at audited financial returns. We're looking at the budget, the sources and uses. We're looking at the collateral. We start with the Treasury curve. So if we think it's a 5 year, we're going to start where that Treasury curve is. Then we have kind of two metrics. We've got the qualitative, which is what does the state require us to do? Environmental justice, statewide, diversified technology, is it in Minnesota, right? So that's a qualitative. And then there's obviously all of the quantitative, the bank underwriting. Depending upon where that project lands, some of them may be notched up from that. Let's say it's a five-year treasury, maybe above the five-year treasury, and some of them may be notched down. Our loans currently range from about 5.87% to 2.5%. And certainly the greater the risk of the project, the more return we're going to, the greater the risk, the higher the interest rate. So we're doing risk-adjusted rates of return.
Representative Sexton.
So let's pursue that qualitative part a little bit more because sure. It's a little fuzzier. How do we get it to less fuzzy and get it into quantitative? I mean, what objective criteria is your guidance within that qualitative block?
This one. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Sexton. The qualitative analysis comes directly from our statute. It says that 50% must be in environmental justice areas. It says that all projects must be in Minnesota. It says that we have to be agnostic to technology and, you know, that we are here to develop projects across the state and on tribal country. And so our qualitative is 100% based on the statute. Our quantitative is 100% based on bank underwriting best practices.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I don't know if I heard correctly, but did you say that these loans, or some of them at least, are on a 47-year revolving schedule?
Ms. Grosswan.
Chair Akam, Representative, no, our average duration of our loans is 4 to 7 years. We recycle our capital back very quickly. That is our goal, because that's how we're catalytic and how we leverage the money to go out and do more projects. Some of our loans are paid back in 2 years. We have a concentration limit. We will not go beyond 10 years with more than 10% of our portfolio. So we aim to stay short because we want to recycle that capital and do more projects in your district and your district and your district.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I apologize for my lack of hearing correctly. But so you're already getting funds coming back in this revolving type loan program. Can you talk about the level of what you're getting back in and going back out again?
Ms. Grossline.
Thank you, Chair Akam. Thank you, Representative. Just to remind you, we started in 2023. When I started in 2024, I had a staff of one. I now have a staff of 13. So we have just started to deploy our loans. We are getting paid back. We are getting quarterly and monthly interest, depending upon the terms of those loans. They are coming right back into our bank account. My CFO is sitting over there sending out invoices, you know, on a regular basis, and we are getting paid back on those loans. We have not yet had one full loan completely turn because of where we are, but we are doing those quarterly monitoring, and we have no concerns with our loans being paid back.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One more question. The amendment we just approved today relieves the state of any liability on notes and loans. So until that would become law, is the state on the hook for some of these loans?
Ms. Grossman.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. No, we are a separate state agency. We are, I think I get this right, a corporate body politic. All of the balance, all of the liability is on ours. When we were working with MMB, they specifically asked that we insert this language. I believe it's the same as like housing and IRRRB, just to be crystal, crystal clear.
Great. Any follow-up, Representative?
So it's kind of like comfort language then.
Yes. It is, sorry.
No, you're good.
Chair Akam, Representative. These are very, very minor tweaks. These are non-controversial. These have no impact on the state budget. These are budget neutral. We are simply here just to do our job and to follow what the statute requires, which is crowding in more money to do more projects.
Great. Okay. And Representative Susinski to close it out.
Thank you. Just kind of thank you, Representative Anderson, for that. So you currently have 13 staff. If we don't approve this, you'll obviously have less funds to process and less loans to process. How many staff would you need? Let's say if you're just dealing with kind of, you said you're a revolving fund. If you just had those funds coming back, how many staff do you think you would need to process that amount of money?
Ms. Grossman.
Thank you, Chair. My org chart after these two hires is nearly complete. Most of the green banks with $105 million with a starting capital stack have about 25 employees. And that's because it becomes catalytic. You loan it out, you get it again. You loan it out, you get it again. We will manage our portfolio of loans, and we've got budget forecasts for the next couple of years, and we have a loan servicing schedule, and we know that the staff that we have are able to service those loans, and we will do so with the staff that we have.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. With that, any closing statements to the bill author?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Grossman, and thank you to members for all of the engaged questions. I think this is a great bill that enables a really great program that has done work all over our state and will continue to do work all over our state, and I hope that we can move this one along.
Yeah. With that, the bill is laid over. And next on our agenda, we will welcome Representative Emma Greenman and House File 76. Welcome to committee. Go ahead, get yourself settled. And while that's going on, I will move that House File 76 be re-referred to the General Register. And I'll request a roll call. With that, let's see. I see that there is an A1 amendment, so I'll go ahead and move the A1. Any questions or discussion on the A1? Did you want to describe the amendment, Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's nice to be back. It's nice to hear about the progress of MNCIFA. It's nice to be back in energy, my first time in the session. The amendment, what it does is it's based on stakeholder feedback. This bill was dropped last year, and we have heard and learned from the rate case and other things, so it just amends and makes a clear administratable rule out of the bill.
With that, all those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 76 is a simple bill that limits the amount of executive compensation that investor-owned utilities can charge back to Minnesota ratepayers. It caps the amount they can charge ratepayers for compensation of their top 10 highest executives at the salary of the Minnesota's chief executive, our governor. Customers pay for utility services, not for executive compensation packages. As utility bills rise for folks across the state, this bill protects Minnesota ratepayers from being nickeled and dimed by private investor-owned monopolies to pay for lavish compensation for their CEOs. And to be clear, this bill wouldn't impact the executive compensation and how much they make. It only impacts the amount of compensation that's put on customer bills and how much is funded by company shareholders. And this isn't a hypothetical problem. Investor-owned utilities are making big profits at the same time as they are trying to charge Minnesota customers millions of dollars for their CEOs and C-suites. In 2025, Xcel made $2.2 billion in profits and sought to charge Minnesota ratepayers $7.3 million for its highest paid executives. And in 2026, it is seeking $7.6 million. And for anybody who says this bill isn't necessary, tell that to the Minnesota families who are struggling to pay their gas and electric bills. Minnesotans are on the hook. Well, these executives of these investor-owned utilities make millions each year. Xcel Chairman, President, and CEO made $13 million in 2024, the last time we have on record of their salary, and the rest of the C-suite made between $2.5 and $4 million, respectively. CenterPoint CEO made $12 million. Minnesota Power Light CEO made $3.7 million, and it goes on. Rest assured that these CEOs won't struggle to pay their utilities or groceries if this bill passes. But for Minnesotans who are struggling, this bill will be a piece of helping them afford their utility bills and their lives. Regulators recognize this issue, and the PUC took action to address it in its rate case with Xcel. And after Xcel challenged it and the court ordered additional process, the PUC recently issued an order capping Xcel's recoverable compensation at $150,000. Which was the governor's salary at the time the rate case commenced. The PUC reasoned that the governor's salary acts as a proxy for what is considered reasonable executive compensation in the public interest. And while I'm encouraged to see the PUC tackling this issue with the regulatory tools we have, it's our responsibility as policymakers to ensure that we're protecting Minnesotans and ratepayers in this regulated monopoly utility system that we set up. And that's what this bill does. It establishes a fair and bright line rule for all recovery, for all large investor-owned utilities in their recovery. And it indexes it to the governor's salary as set by law. So as that increases, this bill will follow that. The bill is just common sense. Why should Minnesota ratepayers be on the hook for paying more to a private for-profit executive than to our own chief executive that voters get to elect who run our entire state? It just makes sense. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd ask for member support, and I believe we have some testifiers.
Yeah, so before we do questions, we'll hear from our testifiers. First, we have Andrea Sorum. Welcome to committee. Go ahead and get yourself seated. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Ikom, Chair Swedinsky, and committee members, my name is Andrea Sorum. I'm a Minneapolis resident and mom to two teenage boys, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the poor in our state. In 2022, I experienced post-viral illness after a COVID infection, and I've been sick with long COVID ever since. I lost all my savings, I lost my career, and even my home is in foreclosure because of this illness. And for the last 4 years, while I've slowly recovered, I've lived with scarcity and fear. While I did not have enough to pay for the basic necessities of life for two kids and a mom, for our housing, for our transportation, for our food, and our heat bill and electric bill. I just got a letter this week from Excel saying that they're going to increase rates 8%, or they're proposing an 8% raise. And for me, that sent a wave of terror through my body. For those of us who are experiencing economic stress, it is important to make sure the precious dollars that we pay for essentials like public utilities are as low as possible. No money from a ratepayer like me should go to line the pockets of already wealthy business owners. Please pass HF 76 to make sure ratepayer dollars are not used to further enrich already wealthy utility executives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sorum. Appreciate you sharing. Next, we have Mitch Diddleston. Welcome to committee. Go ahead and get yourself settled, introduce yourself for the record, and then proceed.
Chair Acom, Co-Chair Swidzinski, and members of the committee, my name is Mitch Diddleston. First of all, happy St. Patrick's Day. I was able to go to the Landmark Center and watch some traditional Irish music, eat some corned beef and cabbage this morning. St. Paul's a wonderful city for Irish traditions. And also, I saw your robin socks. I was sitting behind you there. Representative, spring is close. So my name is Mitch Diddleston. I reside in Minneapolis. I cook Juicy Lucy's over at Matt's Bar on the south side. I spend most of the rest of my time eating, shopping, and recreating in the city. One thing that I deeply cherish about Minneapolis is that there's seemingly endless options to choose from to buy local. I get my shoes from Nakoma's Shoe Store. I buy my bacon at Everett's. I go to Cheapo for my CDs. I get donuts at Bogart's. I work local and I buy local. But I don't have the option to buy local for my energy. And sure, XL Energy is based here in Minnesota, but there's not another utility company that I get to choose from to source my energy. My only option is a Fortune 500 corporation that profits billions of dollars per year by being a monopoly over a basic human need. And life is getting expensive. Gas is up over 50 cents a gallon just in the last week. Grocery prices never go down, and the same is true for our energy at Excel. In times like these, where the average working person, like myself, is being financially pinched in every direction, I want my hard-earned dollars to count. So it goes back to my ethos of buying local. It's not always cheaper, but it directly supports the community that supports me back. I read that Bob Frenzel made $12.94 million in 2024, which happens to be about $12.9 million more than I made in 2024. Allowing a monopoly like Excel to use the profits from working-class Minnesotans to pay the exorbitant salaries of their C-suite executives, it feels disrespectful to our hard-earned paychecks. Please pass this bill to give relief to Minnesotans and ensure that our money isn't going towards wasteful spending. We can get by on less than $13 million per year. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Jolson. Next, we have Carly Weinman from Energy and Policy Institute. Welcome to committee, Ms. Weinman. Please get yourself comfortable, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Acom, Co-Chair Swidzinski, and committee members. My name is Carly Weinman, and I'm a research and communications manager at the Energy and Policy Institute. EPI is a national utility watchdog organization, but I live in Minnesota, and much of my research focuses on investor-owned utilities operating in our state. I'm very proud of that. I have provided expert testimony in two recent Minnesota rate cases, including on the issue of cost recovery of executive compensation. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 76, which ensures that ratepayers are no longer required to subsidize excessive executive compensation at monopoly utilities. This legislation is responsive to an issue that surfaces routinely in Minnesota rate cases. In Xcel's ongoing electric rate case, an astonishing 8,600 public comments have been submitted to the record so far. Many of those specifically emphasize opposition to exorbitant corporate profits and bloated executive pay. I heard this morning from the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota in a presentation delivered to the Public Utilities Commission that roughly 20% of the 4,000 or so comments they've analyzed relate to the issue of executive compensation. This is not a new concern. Previous rate cases across utilities have drawn public comments that reveal ratepayers' distrust and negative perceptions of their utilities based on this issue of executive compensation. Rate case after rate case, we see the same. House File 76 offers a straightforward, common sense solution. This legislation comes at a pivotal time when ratepayers are grappling with a growing affordability crisis. It is important to underscore that utilities operate as monopolies and that their ratepayers are captive customers. If a ratepayer is unhappy with the way their utility operates, they cannot simply choose to take their business elsewhere. It's up to policymakers to safeguard ratepayers' interests and to ensure that adequate statutory guidelines are in place to do so. Crucially, this legislation would in no way restrict a utility's ability to compensate its executives at whatever level it deems appropriate. Any utility could still pay any of its employees at any level of its choosing, using financial resources other than ratepayer money. A utility could, for instance, shift executive compensation costs to shareholders who have broadly enjoyed rising profits over recent years. Xcel, for example, as you've heard, reported $2.2 billion in profits for 2025. It has reported profits in excess of $1 billion each year since 2015. CenterPoint also cleared $1 billion in profits last year. But it's not just about the vast sums of money these utilities generate for their shareholders. It is also the case that executives at investor-owned utilities have an obligation to act in shareholders' interests. They have a fiduciary duty of care to their shareholders and act in shareholders' interests accordingly. That is evident on every earnings call and in every shareholder report. There is not an analogous duty enshrined to ratepayers. Additionally, while ratepayers have no direct mechanism to influence utility executive pay, shareholders do have the privilege of taking an advisory vote on executive compensation packages each year. The asymmetry is clear. House File 76 makes sure executive pay is appropriately funded by those who benefit from it, while preserving full flexibility for utilities to pay their top executives whatever they see fit. It is a targeted, reasonable reform that strengthens accountability and helps protect customers during a time of rising energy costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weinman. Next on our list is Eric Lippman. Welcome back to committee, Mr. Lippman. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Lippman of Utility Reform Now. And as it happens, both Representative Greenman and I are graduates of George Washington University. And as our basketball team will attest, we are both GW revolutionaries. And as good revolutionaries, we're both deeply concerned about highly compensated managers, suboptimal cost controls that beleaguer and immiserate poor people like Ms. Sorum and the other folks who are working poor in District 63B. We're arm in arm on that. Where we part company slightly is where we should begin on those issues. I frankly am concerned that a $3.5 million charge for a single permit, namely the permit to decide whether these 48 numbers on this notice are reasonable or not, we're going to be charged $3.5 million, as shown in the handout, in order to decide that question, whether that's fair or good, again, for folks like Ms. Sorum who are struggling. And so I absolutely agree that we have to lower costs. We have to be firm about overcharging. I'm suggesting, though, that legislators should focus on the folks who are directly under your oversight jurisdiction, namely the folks who are generating rate-making expenses like $3.5 million. So again, I think we should confront the costs and overcharging, but I'm suggesting that we start at East 7th Street before moving on to XL and CenterPoint on Nicollet Mall. Let's start in St. Paul before we move west. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Lippman. Next, we have Jim Pearson with XL Energy. Welcome back to committee, Mr. Pearson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Co-Chair Swedinsky and members of the committee, I'm Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy. I very much appreciate the opportunity to share our perspective on House File 76 and continue our engagement in conversations around affordability. As we've discussed this session, affordability is a top priority for Xcel Energy, and we have a variety of strategies to help maintain affordability, including offering our customers a number of specific affordability programs. I think I'll sort of cut short a little bit about our use of the regulatory process. I think Representative Greenman and some of the other testifiers alluded to that. The process that we use when we submit a rate case in front of the Public Utilities Commission is a very thorough one. It looks not only at executive compensation, but it looks at every cost associated with our business. And the commission is ultimately responsible for determining what costs go in our rates and that our prices are deemed reasonable. So that is the process that we have used for 50 years. Other utilities use it, and one that, although I'm the company is on the other side of in many cases, but it's one that works quite well in our mind. I just wanted to provide a little additional context for today's conversation. Historically, the commission has permitted only a small portion of executive compensation to be recovered from customers. For example, the commission excludes at-risk pay, thus ensuring that the vast majority of executive compensation is already excluded from our rates, at-risk pay being bonuses, incentives, and the like. In addition, Xcel Energy serves across eight states. For many of our executives, their compensation is also shared across multiple jurisdictions. This means that we generally ask Minnesota regulators to include only a percentage of the costs associated with our executive team. I also wanted to provide some perspective around how that team works to benefit our customers. Keep in mind, they bear the responsibility for safety, reliability, environmental performance, of course, affordability. But I'd also like to highlight some of the work that that team does to bring cost back to Xcel Energy, which benefits ratepayers or our customers. So examples of this would be around wind production tax incentives, which that alone has saved Xcel Energy customers millions of dollars over the years we've been engaged in that. And even the Form Battery project that we heard about earlier today is another example of direct executive engagement that brought $70 million, 35 which million came to Minnesota. So this team is also the team that is really involved in some of those conversations at the national at the national level and in Washington, D.C. So again, just wanted to provide that context for today's conversation. The last thing I would say is that even with today's amendment, the language still does not apply broadly, which again raises in our mind some equity concerns. So again, appreciate the conversation, appreciate the ability to share our perspective, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. And last on our list of testifiers, we have Jason Luce from CenterPoint. Welcome back to committee, Mr. Luce. Please go ahead and get yourself seated and go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, chairs, committee members. My name is Jason Luce. I'm the Associate General Counsel at CenterPoint Energy. My testimony will be brief here. I just wanted to note that in CenterPoint Energy's most recent rate case, the PUC approved a total of $428,000 for our 10 highest paid executives compensation, which equates to about $42,800 per executive. On a typical bill, that compromises about 0.4 cents or about 0.41 cents of a dollar. The current process requires the utility to prove executive salary recovery is reasonable and necessary for the provision of the utility service. This is where the Public Utilities Commission sits in a quasi-judicial manner. So it requires us to present evidence and prove our case. In this case, we believe it's a tough but fair burden, one that's worked for, as I believe the previous testifier said, 50 years, and we, again, are happy with the way that that the current process works. And with that, CenterPoint Energy appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony and can answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And with that, we'll go to members' questions and comments. First on the list, we have Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Greenman, for bringing this. I think, as has been stated, you know, we have an affordability crisis here in Minnesota, and energy is top of mind for a lot of folks, including a couple of our testifiers. We can't live without energy in today's age, and so it's really important that when we're talking about a monopoly utility, that we're really holding their feet to the fire. I actually wanted to bring back up Mr. Lippman. I have a question for him.
And Mr. Lippman, please go ahead and introduce yourself again for the record once you get yourself situated.
My materials away, Madam Chair. Representative Jones, how can I help? Eric Lippman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Lippman. So you had mentioned that we should be looking at things that are within our oversight. So just wondering, when we have a regulated utility model in Minnesota, does this body here not have oversight over the utilities?
Mr. Lippman.
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely you do have. I just think a closer core responsibility is to be conducting oversight of the government officials involved. I think that's closer to the purposes of your election certificate, but I'm not doubting that under the Constitution and the commerce powers that you have ability to make the rules that you think are needful for a utility regulation, including the compensation given to utility executives. I just think it's more of a peripheral issue than the performance of the folks who work for us, whose salaries you and I pay.
Ms. Jones.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lippman. So I appreciate that we do agree that this body does have oversight over these regulated utilities. And although it may be true that we maybe should look at some other pieces, that what we have on the agenda today is Rep. Greenman's bill, and we 100% have the jurisdiction to look at what is included in rate cases. And I think it is really important that we're not distracted by other pieces. And yes, those can be in other bills. But today, we need to be looking at executive compensation. And I think as we've been hearing from ratepayers, as we've been hearing from consumer advocates, you know, it just doesn't make sense for ratepayers to be on the hook for these really large compensation packages. And I'll end with that comment.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. And just want to give people a heads up. We've got about 8 minutes and about five questions or members. So first is Representative Mekland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Greenman, the PUC currently does have the ability to regulate how much of the executive salary is being covered by the ratepayers. Is that correct?
Ms. Greenman.
Yep.
Representative Greenman, I apologize.
I'll take it.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Mekland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So why, I mean, I've heard bills in here before that would have got kind of close to taking some of their regulatory effect away or different things we've heard over the years. Why is this one so important? Why wouldn't we just leave it under the guise of the PUC and let them regulate it?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the question because, you know, as we saw with the PUC case, it took 2 years to get to a decision for 2024. This is us doing our job as lawmakers and just setting a clear, bright line rule that applies not just to Xcel, not just to CenterPoint, but Minnesota Power, Otter Tail County, Power and Minnesota Energy Resources. And so I think it is a much easier call for us to just say, We're going to set a bright line rule. That bright line rule is we've already decided that the governor, our chief executive, makes what the Compensation Council makes. I think it's $177,000 now. And that's the amount of money we are going to allow ratepayers to be on the hook for, and not anything more than that.
Any follow-up, Representative Meckland?
Briefly, as a comment, Madam Chair. I find this, not that I disagree, we got to get money back to the ratepayer. I've heard Chair Swedinski bring this issue up year after year after year, and it's always shot down. So I find it kind of interesting for $4.26, whatever it comes out to, when there's been offers of millions and millions going back to the ratepayer in years past, and fortunately, I never made it across. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Next on the list, we have Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try my best to be quick. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing this forward. I just have a couple of things that I want to say. So first, this does impact ratepayers, and the fact that we don't get to choose who our utility providers are has a huge impact on that. I went ahead and looked up what the Thomson Reuters CEO compensation is, because that's the last Fortune 500 company that I worked for. Publicly traded business-to-business corporation, and he made $10.07 million. This is an international business-to-business corporation who made less than the CEO of Xcel Energy. And that business is a business that people can choose to go to, or they can go to a different business-to-business corporation. So when we're looking at CEO compensation, I think it's absolutely reasonable that we look at, you know, energy companies have a monopoly, and when they are being paid better than CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, that's a problem. It's also a problem when private equity looks at an energy company and says, wow, this is such a great investment. They shouldn't be an investment that is so great that private equity wants to invest in this. Like, when we see that, we should automatically think that's a problem, because we're here to serve the people, not to make profit. The second thing I want to say, because I heard a little bit about how the CEOs are involved in so much important work and they're so dedicated and doing, you know, lots of things, which I totally agree with. But doing the calculation, the CEO of CenterPoint makes 108.3 times more than the average lineman. 108.3 times more. That's an insane number. And I think we can all agree that while we support the CEOs doing these business deals and looking into investments, the reality is we need those linemen. We need the people who are actually connecting the people to the energy. Arguably, that is more important than the investments that are being made in innovation and energy storage. Because I tell you what, I care a lot about energy storage. I've carried that bill the entire time I've been in the legislature, and I still would drop that bill in a heartbeat if it meant that I would not have connection to my energy supply, right? And so I think when we're looking at this compensation, it's really important that we think about where it stands within the greater scheme of our economic system, and also where it stands when people can't choose otherwise. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and I'm sorry for nerding out on numbers and doing calculations, but that's the way I process these things. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And I appreciate a couple of members who withdrew their names. So final comment or question from Representative Swedinski, since we're getting short on time here.
Sounds good. Thank you, Chair Akam. And I would just remind, you know, I appreciate the bill as it's written. It sounds like the PUC does kind of handle this when it comes to, you know, executive compensation and rates. And, you know, I think there are a lot of things that we can do. You know, it was brought up by Mr. Littman, you know, like what are we available as legislators? What could we do to affect when it comes to the cost of energy? You know, Representative Jones says there's a crisis in cost when it comes to energy. And we have the ability this session to put millions, if not billions, of dollars back into ratepayers' pockets by the decisions this committee could potentially make. Just the tax on CAS, just a small little portion. There's $59 million sitting in account right now that we could pass a bill out of committee and send it right to ratepayers this in the next 2 weeks. And then there's $50 million a year that get refilled into that committee. Just one small tax on CAS storage, which is carbon-free, which is the future of energy generation in our country. And I understand headlines. I understand gotcha votes. But the actual job of this legislature when it comes to the reaction between increasing cost in energy and decreasing cost in energy, when I've said it before and I'll say it again, we have the ability to get out of the way, to separate ourselves. You know, I think this is a very interesting bill, very debatable. I think it's interesting. I would potentially vote for the bill if I could have the votes to do that exact thing, to return $60 million. I would reach across the party line and pass this bill today if I have the guarantee from every one of these members in this committee that we could immediately put $60 million back into ratepayers' pockets and put $50 million each and every single year back into ratepayers' pockets. That's something we could do like that. But I have a feeling that's not the conversation we're having today. Whether it's property taxes, whether that's sales tax on energy, billions of dollars that this body puts on the cost of ratepayers each and every day and year across the state of Minnesota. So I like the idea of this bill, but if we want to effectually change the cost of energy, we first need to be willing to get out of the way. Thank you.
Closing statement, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the discussion. And the good news is, if you vote for this bill today, it doesn't stop any of that conversation. This is a very simple bill, and it is a bill that we know will ensure that we are protecting ratepayers from the executive compensation that these private investor-owned utilities are making. You heard in this testimony today, the only people you heard saying this system is working is from Xcel and CenterPoint. You heard about comments from the public being concerned about this. You've heard about the PUC in their rate case and then going to court trying to limit it. And you have heard from members who all agree that we want to keep rates down. And so I think this is a good vote to vote with the people we have a fiduciary duty with. These corporations do not have a fiduciary duty to their ratepayers. They have a fiduciary duty, as you heard, to their investors. But it's our job to be to Minnesotans and to ratepayers who are going to pay these bills to protect them from being nickeled and dimed by the private investor-owned companies. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd love a vote. I'd love your support.
I renew my motion that House File 76, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register, and the clerk may take the roll.
Chair Acom?
Aye.
Chair Acom, aye. Chair Subzinski?
No.
Chair Subzinski, nay. Vice Chair Kraft?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kraft, aye. Vice Chair Murphy?
No.
Vice Chair Murphy, nay. Representative Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Representative Anderson, no. Representative Baker? Representative Baker, no. Representative Buck?
Huh, yes.
Representative Buck, yes. Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative Carroll, aye. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Igo?
Igo, no.
Representative Igo, no. Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Jones, aye. Representative Luger-Nicolai?
Aye.
Representative Luger-Nicolai, aye. Representative Muhammad?
Aye.
Representative Muhammad, aye. Representative Mecklen?
Nay.
Representative Mecklen, nay. Representative Sexton?
No.
Representative Sexton, nay. Representative Wiener?
No.
Representative Wiener, nay.
There not being 9 votes, the motion does not prevail. Therefore, it will be laid over. And with that, everyone, this meeting is adjourned.